Good morning, everyone. If we could please come to order. Representative Erdahl, I think you promised brevity, accuracy, and wit and humor. And in exchange for that, you get to go first. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dean Erdahl. And you've put too many demands on me this morning.
In exchange for those demands, I will move that House File 908 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Please proceed, sir.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I do appreciate the the opportunity to be here today to talk about, I think, an important change that we need to make in state law. The Shared Workers Program allows workers to share hours or days with other workers, thus allowing an employer who might otherwise be forced to lay off workers to keep more people employed at fewer hours. The program is through deed and is for 1 year. A six-month hiatus from the program is mandatory once the year is completed and before it can be renewed. In prosperous economic times, this works. In a recession, it leads to layoffs. House File 908 will drop the six-month hiatus provision, keeping workers employed and with benefits. This program is modeled after a 1994 federal law and has, I think, been very successful over the years. I do have one testifier, Steve Michael from Dura Supreme and Howard Lake, who will explain how the program has benefited their area.
If Mr. Michael could please come forward. Good morning, Mr. Michael. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Michael, M-I-C-H-E-L.
Please continue.
I work for a business in Howard Lake known as Dura Supreme Cabinetry. Our business is a semi-custom residential cabinetry manufacturer. Our product is distributed across the United States. We have about 550 employees, and we're a privately held business. We don't disclose our sales, but they're between $50 and $100 million. We participated in the Shared Work Program, and our plan expired at the end of February 2009. I began working several months before the one-year plan expired with Deed to get an extension of the program as we saw the economic conditions continuing to deteriorate, and the program is working very well for us. Essentially, we carried about 100 extra employees. We were overstaffed by about 100 people due to the downturn in our orders, but we didn't lay those people off because we had use of the Shared Work Program. We found it to be a very beneficial program, both for us as an employer, for employees, and we think that the state and the taxpayer benefit from this program as well. As I said, I worked with the Deed to get our program extended, and they informed me that there was a mandatory six-month gap that was required. You could write a one-year plan, then you needed to be out for 6 months, and then you could get back in the plan and write another one-year plan. And the program is actually pretty ingenious in that there really isn't an added cost, and there's just added benefits to the constituents, as I indicated. In normal economic times, this plan works great. A one-year maximum period, and then 6 months out, an employer can generally plan around a downturn and have it work. In the current economic situation, however, our business would benefit from an extension, the ability to extend this program.
Right. Are there any questions either for the author of the bill or Mr. Michael? Is there anyone in the audience? Thank you, audience. my pronunciation needs a little work today, but the staff is here to help. Anyone in the audience wishing to testify either before or for or against House File 908? Seeing none, Representative Erdahl, any closing comments?
Just thank you very much. I personally think that this should go right to the consent calendar and get these people working, but look forward to what other stops we have to make, and hopefully we'll be able to move this along quickly, because it does keep people employed and it does end some potential layoffs, and I think that's one of all of our goals in this economic time.
Well, we don't have the opportunity to send it to the consent calendar, but I will renew my motion that House File 908 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. You're off.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Michael. Thank you for coming today. Representative Mahoney, I believe you are up next. House File 927. President Mahoney, it's Friday the 13th.
Is that bills up on Friday the 13th, a lot in your committee? It's a good
Yeah, staff confirmed.
It's a good thing you have good staff.
It is. Representative Mahoney, would you like to move your bill?
I would like to move House File 927, and I believe it has to go to the your parent division.
Representative Mahoney moves that House File 927 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Mr. Chair, committee members, there are two amendments in there. We'll take the A amendment, which is the smaller of the two, first. On page 2, line 22, it adds in the language, nothing herein shall prohibit an offer to sell, repair, or perform services provided. Those services are performed by a licensed person. It's a lot of comfort language for and clarification language for large utilities and some other people that advertise, and they don't want to get caught up in some kind of suit with the or enforcement action with the Department of Labor and Industry, and I can explain a little bit more as we get in.
Right. Representative Mahoney, this is your amendment.
This is my amendment.
Your order. Any questions to the author? Hearing
what number?
I'm sorry. The A amendment. It's on the legal size piece of paper. No, that's not legal. It's just not my morning. 8.5 by 11. Does everyone have the amendment before them?
Effort.
All right. Representative Mahoney has moved the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Mahoney, you have a second amendment.
I have a second amendment. The 08 amendment deals with water conditioning contractors and installer standards. That's a little bit more detailed, and it's better that I explain it in my notes, if I might just put it on the bill at the present time and explain it in the whole process.
Representative Mahoney has moved the 08 author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Mahoney, see your bill is amended, sir.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I might have lost the sheet. I can start. I did move the sheet. Section 1, in the amended bill, changes the word service to issuance. It's pretty much just lawyer comfort language, lawyer and department comfort language. Section 2 in the new amended bill adds the subdivision, as a new subdivision to unadvertised licensing. But that's the 8.5 by 11 amendment. We have a tremendous amount of people advertising the service, and they are, how should I say it? They're not licensed. And they're claiming that they are licensed. So this gives some teeth to the ability to not to enforce that law. If you're going to advertise as licensed, you've got to be licensed. Section 3, this amendment it cleans up last year's statewide building code. The current language exempts the interior plumbing system from being required to comply with plumbing code when it's connected to a well or a septic system. This would require the plumbing installation to meet all the codes, and it doesn't matter if you're on a municipal water or sewer supply system or a well or septic system. What we're trying to do is get the plumbing code across the whole state. And this was inadvertently, this was an inadvertent mistake on our part that because the language wasn't quite correct, we didn't kill enough trees on that particular bill to keep the people on wells and septic systems in the plumbing code. Section 4, 6, 9, 10. This is actually the amendment, the larger amendment we put on with water conditioners. They were exempted from the plumbing code. We are trying to get them underneath the plumbing code. There's an exemption for cities under 5,000 water conditioners. It puts them on the same level of licensing and code compliance as a plumber, the restricted plumber. Right now, if you are a restricted plumber, you have to get which is a city under 5,000, you have to get a separate license to put a water conditioning system in. Kind of eliminates that particular part. Section 5 is the, we actually included the restricted plumbers, journeyman plumbers, in the requirement for a bond. That is really only supposed to be for those who take out the permit, which would be the master plumber. So there's no reason for someone who just gets in their truck in the morning and works for someone, gets in their truck in the morning, goes out to someone's home to fix their plumbing to have a bond. That should be the person who pulled the permit. Section 7, 8, and 11 is the cities under 5,000 exemption for water conditioning installers and contractors, and it removes that exemption. In the original bill, we had a fix, what everyone thought was a fix until everyone read it, to something called the maintenance and repair of high pressure steam systems. Once everyone read it, they decided that it had to come out. So that is not part of the bill. We're trying to keep this as non-controversial or as few controversial issues as we can. I want to make sure I am getting to all of these, and I've got to 11. I'm going to actually, Mr. Chair, I have to go back to my desk because
all right.
I left my one sheet there.
Reviewing the bill, Representative Mahoney, and previous to the committee hearing, it did occur to me that we should have had you go forth because it looks primarily that you're batting cleanup here today.
Well, Mr. Chair, there are some other bills coming down that might be amended into this bill at some point or rolled into this bill at some point, and I think having read all those bills, they're pretty good, but I have to get to Mankato for a conference by noon. It's going to be tough. Section 12 of the amended bill removes unnecessary words. Section 13, this amendment reinserts the words that when the statute was amended and renumbered, we took out the ability to hold anyone accountable for statute 326B.84. We took out the words owner and officer, and this puts them back in, so those are the people who would be accountable for any violation. Section 14, it clarifies that the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, not the High Pressure Piping Systems Board, is responsible for issuance of permits and hiring inspectors. Section 15, back in 2000, the last time we had a budget crisis, we eliminated one of the programs that allowed, if you had a boiler or were manufacturing tanks, you could have an audit done in state. We eliminated that particular program. Manufacturers have found that it cost them about $5,000 to go out of state, while it would cost about $1,700 to have our inspectors do it. This puts that language back in that they are willing to pay our inspectors their standard rate to come out and do that inspection. Section 16 is it extends rulemaking authority for the commissioner for the continuing education of boiler engineers and a few other things in boiler inspectors. Section 17, this section requires the plumbing board to notify the plumbing code to include any provisions relating to water conditioning installation. And this would allow the plumbing board to use good cause exemption to shorten the rulemaking process, thus saving some money. I've talked to a good number of the large water conditioning companies. They're supportive of this. I have a call out to some of the smaller ones, and they are always more difficult to get a hold of, but I remain willing to talk to them if they have issues to try to address them. But they have not contacted me at all, Mr. Chair. And with that, I can stand for questions.
All right. Do you have any testifiers, President Mahoney?
Not if you don't need them.
Flying solo. any questions for the office? Representative Zeller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you got ahead of my question as to some of the other bills coming before and why they couldn't be. I understand that the subdivision is the division where we go through all the bills and then once they get to the full Commerce Committee. But, Representative Mahoney, I just encourage you to for our committee's sake, time for your time, wrap them all in together if they do fit, because we're hearing them all, and then we end up hearing all of them like we have in full committee. And I'd like to see you. I trust you on this, even though I might vote against you. I trust you to take the least controversial or the most appealing parts of these bills and put them into one and move that instead of a whole bunch of 15 different pieces parts.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative
Mahoney,
whenever you bring a code bill for us, it's almost like a tax bill with the amount of people that want to add things in. So I pretty flat out told everyone that we're going to take the department's bill and whatever is non-controversial, I told the department to put into the bill and let people fight it out, and then it can come to me. And it's starting, the dust is clearing, and we're going to find a few bills that will fit into this bill eventually.
Right, so
you're right.
Chairman, I trust the deference. Thank you. I trust the deference of the fine member from St. Paul.
Any other questions or bait for the office? Seeing none. With that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House File 927, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Hortman, I saw you come in the room, I saw it.
Yes.
She is. Representative Lilly, would you like to move that House File 578 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor?
Representative Lilly.
Would you like to move the bill, Representative Lilly?
I'd be pleased to do that.
Thank you very much. Representative Hortman, your bill has been moved. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know how usually people say it's a simple bill, it's a non-controversial bill? Well, this is a complicated bill, and there's a little bit of controversy, so I can't make those disclaimers. This is about indemnity in design services and contracts related to that. And when the consulting engineers came to my office and told me what they needed, it sounded very simple and very straightforward. And then when admin came and told me why they didn't like this bill, it sounded very simple and very straightforward. And the two parties are talking to each other about their differing views of the bill, so we're moving towards peace in the valley. But I'll let one of the consulting engineers explain to you what House File 578 does.
Good. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please introduce yourself to the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Would you prefer I sit or stand?
Sitting is just fine. We do a lot of that around here.
My name is Mark Bloomquist. I'm actually a lawyer at the Meeringer Law Firm, and I represent a number of architects and engineers, and that's my primary practice. And I was asked to help introduce the bill just to answer some questions and to summarize it. It probably isn't as complicated as some people would think, at least not for me as a lawyer. The problem we're trying to fix, and I speak for the architects and engineers and other licensed professionals in the construction industry, and that would be architects, engineers, land surveyors, people that are licensed by Chapter 326 of the statute. In the construction industry, we have a statute in Chapter 337 that says that you cannot be required to pay for someone else's fault. So if someone else makes a mistake, you can't be required to indemnify them for their own mistake. However, there's an exception to that that says if you are required to buy insurance for the other person's mistake, then that is fine. Which sounds all well and good because then you pass all the risk to the insurance industry. The problem we're trying to fix is for professionals, that such as architects, engineers, people licensed under Chapter 326, insurance is not available to cover for somebody else's mistake or somebody else's fault. So when the engineers are presented with a contract that says you will indemnify us and you will buy insurance to cover your obligation of indemnity, and indemnity means to be responsible for someone else's fault, when an engineer is faced with that contract, he goes to his insurance rep, his insurance agent says, sorry, that type of insurance is not available to professionals. That insurance is only available to non-professionals. So, for instance, a building contractor, someone who actually builds this building, can buy insurance to cover himself for someone else's fault. So that's the point of the bill. I'd be happy to answer questions on the specifics, but the intent is to create a new definition to distinguish between standard construction contracts and professional contracts. And for professional contracts, the goal is to prevent professionals from being forced to enter into contracts where they can't provide insurance.
Thank you very much. Representative Hortman, you have another testifier. Sir, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and continue with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Robert DeGroat, and I'm a professional engineer, professional geologist, licensed in Minnesota, and I'm a principal with the firm of AECOM. What I wanted to do today is just explain the reality of the situation of what's actually occurring in the marketplace. And what is occurring is, number one, firms with significant assets or assets that are available are walking away from opportunities to provide engineering services for individuals, government included, because they are putting assets at risk under the indemnification clauses that are being presented. The intent of the indemnification clauses are to actually provide protection for the owner and to provide that protection through the use of insurance. When insurance isn't available, it then falls to the assets of those companies to provide that coverage because you don't have the insurance coverage associated with it. For large companies that have assets, they put their assets at risk. For small companies that have no assets, and in a lot of engineering service-related industries, there are no assets associated. There's a computer, a desk, and a shingle hung out the door. They have very little to put at risk. So even though their insurance coverage will not provide protection for the owner, they have no assets either that they're putting to risk. So what's occurring is this false illusion of protection for the owner. So what happens is, one, you lose the opportunity to have high quality, well established firms with assets walk away from opportunities to provide services. So that's one of the concerns associated with it. And two, you have this false illusion of protection for the owner relative to firms that have no assets and no insurance protection for these indemnification clauses.
All right. Thank you, Mr. DeGroot. Questions for the author or testifiers? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 578? Sir, please come forward. You may have followed the drill. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, and good morning to the board. My name is Justin Kaufman. I am an attorney and contract negotiation specialist with the Minnesota Department of Administration. I work within a group that oversees professional and technical services contracts and approve those contracts, and it's in that capacity, as well as I'm a constituent of Representative Simons here, that I come here to
deny on him
to respectfully speak against the bill. And we're lucky we've had a good opportunity to speak with the folks who have already spoke before me this morning. Over the course of maybe the past year or more than the past year, to try to come to terms on some language that would be suitable to both them and to the state. We've had the opportunity to speak about this as well with Representative Hortman, and have appreciated that. And what I wanted to do... I'm sorry?
Not
me. Okay. What I wanted to do was to go ahead and just share some of the same things with this board that I've been privileged to share with Representative Hortman. The first thing I want to point out is that anytime we talk about this bill, there's reference to Chapter 337. And what we have here is a question of whether or not this statute even applies to contracts with the state. And this goes back to laws of statutory construction, that unless the state is named out as being bound to statutes, it's presumed that they're not. So we have this ongoing disagreement with some of the folks that we've chatted with who presented earlier as to whether this even applies to the state or not. So that's the first issue and our concern as far as the establishment of statutory intent. Now, anything I move on from here presumes that this statute does in fact apply to state contracts, all right, even though I hold that it does not. So bear with that logic. The idea here with the statute is a couple of things. One, we're talking about indemnification on contract by professional services, and I want to make sure we understand the distinction. This language would, in fact, change work being done by expert witnesses, studies being done by licensed professionals, boring tests, surveying, CAD drawing, and other work that's done by architects and professional engineers, as well as land surveyors, landscape architects, and interior designers. This broadens out the scope of what the current protection already is for those doing architectural work and construction work, and design work for that matter, and it stretches out to cover sort of the rest of the industry. The nature of that work is very different. The existing language that protects construction and architecture is there to protect a unique industry. The design, or rather the studies and the expert witness and the other professional services that are performed by these folks are much more in line with the other professional and technical services that come through the state. And the question becomes why we provide a special exemption to this industry for their services alone. The other issue we have is that in the time where we're dealing with increased budget constraints, both at the state and county and city levels, we're being asked again on these types of contracts to put the burden back on the states, on the municipalities, and to have them assume that liability. This issue of whether or not they can insure over all of their obligations or all of their liabilities is the same issue we face in every single contract. It's the same thing that all contractors, really across the board for professional and technical services, have to deal with and have to realize, whether dealing with the state or dealing with private entities, that they in fact have some risk they cannot insure over. That's the truth for business. I think it's the truth for every single person in this room. We all have liabilities we can't insure over. So that's the crux of my argument. I have a few issues that are probably rather boring relating to, I acknowledge that, relating to how some of the language is drafted. I'll try to make this brief. But what we talked about, and we've had conversations actually even this morning, that we would like to continue our conversations with the folks from the architectural and engineering groups and see what we can come to agreement on, that I'm really not certain the language they're proposing achieves what it is they're trying to achieve. I think rather it also comes to the state and it modifies the liability language, changes some standards, and puts us in a difficult position of one, understanding whether or not the statute would apply. Two, the way it's written, we would have great difficulty trying to implement with any real level of confidence what's in the statute. So there are a number of reasons. And I'll point out one issue. And that is a definition that's in the bill under 337.01 sub 2A. I apologize for the reference. It's
page 1, lines 19 and 20.
The professional services means a contract for services that are provided by a person licensed under 326.02 to 326.15. And I'll point out to you something that seems a little bit far-fetched but possible. And that is, what if a person licensed as an interior designer also works in another capacity, let's say as an IT consultant? Under the strict read of the language that's here, in whatever type of work that person is performing, they would get the protections because they're licensed. Okay? It's far-fetched, but that's one example of the language and how we don't think that what's here is really going to achieve what they're trying to do, or at least that there's a much better means of doing so.
All right.
With that, I'm going to conclude, and I'm happy to answer any questions folks may have.
Thank you, Mr. Kaufman. Questions for the author or any of the testifiers? Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 578? Representative Hortman, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this bill, obviously, as you can tell, it has brought the parties together, and there's a lot of conversation going on. I expect there's a lot of conversation that will continue. And so I'm really interested in whether it's the will of the committee to pass this bill forward and have these negotiations continue and then the next hearings in the Commerce Committee, or whether you would prefer to lay it over until more conversations have occurred and they're closer to being in the same place.
Representative Solver.
And I have one question. Has there been a fiscal note requested on this one?
Representative Hortman.
I have not requested a fiscal note because I didn't really see the connection to state contracting until recently.
Okay.
So, I can certainly request a fiscal note.
If you just have Brian do that, that'd be fine.
Am I hearing from you, Representative Hartman, a commitment to continue to work with Department of Administration as well as the folks you're representing here today on the language?
Absolutely, and I wouldn't want to go forward in Commerce until it was very clear that either they could agree or that their disagreements are very well defined.
All right. With that commitment, appreciate that, Representative Hortman. Representative Lilly renews his motion that House File 578 be recommended to pass, given an opportunity to be worked on, and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hortman.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 528. Representative Dabney, would you like to make a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to move that House File 528 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Okay. If people have heard the motion, Representative Dabney, you want to explain your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As we see the economy continue to unravel, one of the groups most affected are these very group who's eligible to purchase reverse mortgages, and that's our senior citizens who are living on fixed incomes. They're relying on Social Security, a pension if they have one, and their investment income. Unfortunately, as the economy has unraveled, the third leg of that stool, the investment income, has gotten significantly shorter than the other two legs. House File 528, then, is a proactive preventative measure to especially focus on the growing but under-regulated proprietary reverse mortgage market. While currently upwards to 90% of the reverse mortgages sold in Minnesota are federally backed and regulated HECM mortgages, we are seeing locally and nationally an accelerated development of proprietary products that do not carry all of the same protections, are being aggressively marketed, are increasingly complex, sold as investment vehicles, and coupled with a growing demand from Wall Street
for these products in the securitization, for the securitization market. We feel that it now is the time to act proactively to assure these marketing regulations get put into place to protect our senior citizens going forward. With me today, Representative Mr. Chair, is Ms. Heil from the Attorney General's Office, who can walk through the bill.
Okay. And why don't we try to have about 10 minutes for pros and 10 minutes for cons in this bill, if that's time enough. Ms. Heil, would you identify yourself for the tape, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carla Heil. As Representative Dabney said, this bill is intended to be proactive and preventive. Additionally, as Representative Dabney said, most of the market presently is with the federally insured. However, and the federally insured ones did get greater regulations in October in 2008, and the intent of this bill is to extend that to all reverse mortgages sold in Minnesota, and also to provide greater protections. Sections 1 and 2 of the bill conform Minnesota's law to the federally insured ones. Section 3 extends counseling to all reverse mortgages in Minnesota. Under the Federal Act, counseling is required by a HUD-certified counselor to the senior citizen. And also, this bill talks about positively promote plus 60 minutes. Counselors have said it does take 60 minutes to actually go through all the issues. What we want to do is prevent the coaching and instead having the senior see other benefits or other alternatives to reverse mortgages. Section 4 and Section 5 relate to lender responsibility. Section 4 in particular talks about that if the lender does not pay, then the mortgage can be declared null and void if they do not cure the default. Section 5 goes with that the purchaser of the mortgage is responsible for the acts of the originator. I believe that's also to prevent what we have seen in the subprime market where bad mortgages may be resold. Section 6 relates to the right of rescission. This gives 30 days to have the senior rescind the reverse mortgage. Other statutes in Minnesota law also has a right of rescission, and this is a very important issue. It's the senior citizens, probably their greatest asset, and even if the truth in lending law would have 3 days, we want to extend it to 30 days so they get time to talk to other people and possibly rescind if necessary. Section 7 has a definition of suitability. As Representative Dabney said, this is marketed to seniors as a financial plan. People who sell insurance and securities in Minnesota also have to determine suitability, and that's what this is also. Section 9 relates to the cross-selling. This also is provided under federal law, but what this is, it prevents the selling of insurance, annuities, long-term care with the proceeds of a reverse mortgage.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, there is a testifier from AARP who's also wanting to testify in favor of the bill. Lucent Social Service was not able to be here today, but is also in support of the bill.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the tape, please, and spell your last name.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 528, legislation authored by Chairman Dabney to help protect consumers of reverse mortgages. I'm Shirley Hunt Alexander, a member of AARP's Executive Council. And this is an important bill. There's no question about it to our seniors. I would like to thank, and AARP certainly would like to thank, you, Mr. Chair, and Attorney General Lori Swanson for their leadership in bringing this legislation forward. Older Minnesotans, as you have stated, have been among the hardest hit by the economic crisis. Many have lost retirement savings and employment while struggling to pay for the increasing cost of living. For most older Minnesotans, our home constitutes the biggest and most important part of our life savings, which we'd like to leave to you, by the way. And in fact, two-thirds of Americans age 65 and older own their homes free and clear. In today's economic downturn, older homeowners across the state are increasingly turning to reverse mortgages to pay for life necessities, such as needed home repairs, health care, or long-term care, and sometimes property tax, by the way. AARP believes that, in general, reverse mortgages should be used as a last resort for most consumers. We know that reverse mortgages can be a useful safety net for many Minnesotans who have no other choice and want to remain living independently, and it's pretty attractive when it's first presented. I want to call your attention to several areas of the bill that we believe will have a positive, protective impact on consumers. We support the suitability clause intended to ensure that reverse mortgages are sold only to people who need them. Lenders should be held responsible for selling homes that they know are bad for a particular consumer. We also support the prohibition of cross-selling. Too often, the home equity of borrowers is depleted because they are often inappropriate financial products, such as annuities or long-term care insurance. Consumers should be wary of anyone who tries to sell them something to be paid for with a reverse mortgage. If anyone is trying to sell you something and recommending you use a reverse mortgage to pay for it, that's generally a pretty good sign that you don't need it and shouldn't be buying it. Any help we can get in that area is good. And we also suggest the mandatory counseling provision of the bill, and are pleased that the time frame in which consumers can reconsider their loan is expanded. That's important, because sometimes we have second thoughts. We are pleased that the bill increases the responsibility of lenders so that the originator and the buyer of the loan can both, and repeat that, can both be held responsible for any unscrupulous actions by the loan originator. And we've seen enough of that, haven't we? We believe this bill will help protect those homeowners who may be considering a reverse mortgage to meet their needs and ensure that they get a fair product that best meets their needs. And we are looking forward to working with you to see that this important legislation is enacted. And thank you so much.
Thank you. Did you have any other testifiers?
I do not, Representative Solberg. I do know that there is at least one individual in the audience wishing to testify on the bill.
Sure. Let's call in anybody who would like to testify against the bill. Come on down, Mr. Nemke. And there are two chairs there, so we can make arrangements. Welcome to the committee, if you can identify yourself for the tape, Mr. Lemke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matthew Lemke. I'm with the law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein, and I'm here on behalf of the Mortgage Bankers Association. And from the outset, I'd like to thank the author for having an open door, and we'll continue to work with him as this bill goes forward. In the current form the bill's in, the Mortgage Bankers Association does oppose the bill, but we're optimistic that that we can come to a compromise on this bill. As a result of the growth in the reverse mortgage market, lenders are becoming increasingly interested in making reverse loans. While the Mortgage Bankers Association supports the entry of lenders in the market, we also understand reverse mortgages are marketed to a potentially vulnerable population. MBA wholeheartedly supports protections for these consumers. The consumer protections should be adequate in the counseling standards and have a clear plan for the payment of taxes and fees for mortgage property. A bill should provide safeguards for both consumers as well as the lender. NBA proposes that HECM loans and reverse mortgages should all adhere to the following counseling provisions. I should probably explain what a HECM loan is. Reverse mortgages that are approved by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, for participation in the Federal Housing Administration, FHA, Home Equity Conversion Mortgage program. Got that?
Hey,
that,
yep.
That makes complete sense.
Good acronym.
Good, good. So HECM's easier than saying that every time. So we'll go with HECM. The reason I bring up the HECM is that the majority, if not all, of the products right now are HECM, and HECM products are under pretty strict federal guidelines on in different areas, and I think somebody else might explain a little bit more on what those guidelines are. But I'll be very brief here. The counseling provisions, we believe that prior to making a reverse mortgage loan, a lender should refer the prospective borrower to HUD-approved counselors and have a face-to-face or a telephone counseling meeting. That's in the bill, and not the telephone part, but the counseling provision is in the bill, and we support that. A lender shall not accept the final and complete application for a reverse mortgage loan from a prospective applicant or assess any fees. That also is in the bill, and we support that. The information covered in the counseling session shall include options other than a reverse mortgage that are available to the homeowner, including other housing, social service, health, and financial options. That's in the bill, and we support it. Other reverse mortgage options that are or may become available to the homeowner, such as a sale leaseback financing, deferred payment loans, and property tax deferral. That's in the bill, and we support it. The financial implications of entering into a reverse mortgage, in the bill, support. A disclosure that a reverse mortgage may have tax consequences, affect eligibility for assistance under federal and state programs, and have an impact on the estate and heirs of the homeowner, in the bill, and we support that. We'd actually be open to adding language to allow that upon the request of the borrower, other parties shall be permitted to attend the counseling sessions with the borrower, something we'd like to further discuss with the author as the bill moves forward. If I could just touch very briefly on some of the issues that we do have with the bill. Section 3, Subdivision 8, this isn't our largest concern, but there's the provision in there that the lender shall positively promote the benefits of reverse mortgage counseling to the borrower. That's not in the federal language, and we think that might promote litigation, so we think that language is unnecessary. Probably a more serious consequence in that section is it's not exactly clear. There's a civil penalty in that provision that looks like it could apply to a lender if the counselor didn't do something correctly, and we just want to make sure that provision is clarified. In Section 4 and 5, Subdivision 9, and 4 and 5, Subdivision 9 and Subdivision 10, this is the lender default provision and the lender responsibility. We're worried that as drafted, these two provisions may make it difficult, if not impossible, to actually sell these reverse mortgages to in the marketplace. So we'd like to continue to work with the author on that. Section 6, there's the right of rescission, and as the testifier from the Attorney General's office pointed out, currently under federal law, there's a 3-day rescission for most products of this nature. This has a 30-day rescission. We think that 30-day timeline is too long. We'd like to see that shortened. The reality is the financial means will not be dispersed until actually that rescission period is ended. That's just the practicality of what will happen in a situation like that. Just to wrap up here, the suitability requirement is more suitable for the counseling. That's the area where a disinterested third party should actually be discussing a lot of these issues with the potential borrower, and a suitability requirement, kind of an apples and oranges comparison to the insurance market. We think this is a different type of product, and like I said, would probably be better in the counseling provisions. The final part is the cross-selling limitations, and we agree that there should be limits on cross-selling to make sure that the vulnerable population isn't sold a product by using some of the resources that a reverse mortgage allows them to have. We don't think the total prohibition that's in here is the best way to go, so we'll continue to work with the author on what we think is a reasonable approach there. Thank you.
Okay. You have another witness? Maybe you can just slide forward and get closer to the mic and identify yourself.
Hi, thank you. I'm Beth Patterson, and Patterson is spelled P-A-T-E-R-S-O-N for the record.
Thank you.
I'm with Prestige Mortgage Reverse Mortgages SIDEC, and I have specialized in reverse mortgages for the last 10 years. And I have done both the HECM, which is HUD's product, as well as proprietary products. Right now, there are no proprietary products available throughout the country, certainly not in Minnesota. but I have done the ones that were available in Minnesota, so I'm very familiar with all of the products. And I'm proud to say that all of my loans that were HUD's have been insured by HUD. We haven't had any issues with that, and also I have had no rescissions through the years, and I've done hundreds of loans. In the last year, about 300 reverse mortgages were done, and I'm pretty sure almost all of them, if not all of them, were the HECM, because proprietaries started going out earlier in the year. And while right now there's not any on the books of coming forward, I recognize that we need to look at protecting our seniors. I've been an advocate with the seniors. I work with very closely with the senior advocacy organizations as well as adult protection agencies. And reverse mortgages have made a huge difference in my clients' lives. It's allowed them to retire. Many of them have felt like they have to work in order to make their current mortgage payment, and doing the reverse mortgage has allowed them to retire. It's helped them pay medical bills or prescriptions. Foreclosure. I can't tell you how many people we pull out of foreclosure with our reverse mortgage, and which is kind of one of those mixed blessings. It's good that we can do it, but at the same time, sorry that they're in that situation. It just sometimes gives them that little elbow room to afford their needs, their daily living expenses. And I think AARP mentioned about home repairs and taxes, not relying on their investments. And most of them don't qualify for a conventional loan, because with a conventional loan, income and creditworthiness is required. And with a reverse mortgage, we do not require income or creditworthiness. And our interest rate is a lot lower than if they were going to do a conventional loan. There's actually talk with government agencies about utilizing reverse mortgages to help people stay in the community, which helps save government dollars. There are restrictions in this bill, as Matt pointed out, that will prevent lenders from offering reverse mortgages in the state, and that is a concern of mine because they do such a good job. HUD and RESPA have regulations in place regarding both the HECM and the proprietary products. And the application and the closing documents that are for the HECM are also utilized for the proprietary products. And I did send an email out and included a package with sample documents along that line. We are required, and this is whether it was a HECM or whether it was a proprietary product when they were available, to give at least two samples of different options with the reverse mortgage. We also are required to give them an amortization schedule, a total annual loan cost, important terms. The disclosures include the annuity and estate planning that is not required with the reverse mortgage. There's distinct language regarding that in all of the documents. We also, at the time of application, have to leave borrowers with the sample closing documents, including the mortgage, the notes, so they have an opportunity through the whole process to read those documents, take them to their attorney, and they can also, anytime during the process, cancel out of the loan. So there is a lot of time for them to do that. One of the other things we're required to leave with borrowers is Fannie Mae's little booklet called Considering a Reverse Mortgage, and it goes through some of the risks that are there. Usually reverse mortgages are the only viable option for seniors.
Ms. Patterson, we're going to have to try to speed up your testimony.
Okay. I want to say that the process from the time that the borrower has to first talk to us or our counselor to all the way through to the closing is generally 40 days or more, so there is a lot of time for them to review the documents and talk to their families and friends through the process of all of that. The 30-day rescission is impossible. There's a lot of factors, and I won't go into that right now. I will be willing to talk to the authors or others regarding that. I have some other suggestions. One is for the counseling that, and I think Matt kind of covered that a little bit, counseling follow the HUD protocol. They've worked on this through years. They're continually working on proving, but just add proprietaries are required to go through the counseling also. Suitability, to have that under the counselors, but make it, let it be the borrower's decision whether they want to proceed. Cross-selling, I totally agree, and we can talk more about that. Another suggestion that isn't in this bill but I think would be very important is testing and licensing of anybody originating a reverse mortgage, and that will help those who are only doing one or two a year that may not be, look over here, that may not be real familiar with the products. Those are the ones who are probably trying to do more of the forcing than those of us who have a lot of experience with the industry and know the product. So that would be another better option, as well as making that list of who's qualified available to the public.
All right, thank you, Ms. Patterson, very much. Questions? Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, hopefully, for either Ms. Patterson or Ms. Valensky. Could you explain quickly the differences between a reverse mortgage and a home equity loan?
Mr. Lemke, would you like to take that one, please? Or Ms. Patterson?
Okay. A home equity loan is a what we call a forward loan. It's a loan like you or I have on our property to use to either purchase the home or to finance buying the home through the years or refinance. Reverse mortgage borrowers have to be 62 or older. We don't care about income or creditworthiness. And a conventional home equity loan, you get the money in a lump sum. A reverse mortgage, you can take money in monthly payments, a line of credit, or a lump sum. The most common way people do take the proceeds is a line of credit, so they can just pull it as they need it. Does that answer the question?
Thank you.
Representative Zellers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The period, the cancellation period is what has some concerns on, because not only from a from the consumer standpoint, but from an availability of capital. We've heard a lot of times that the banks have the money, but they're not lending it, or maybe they don't have the money. But if you're going to, as you said, hold the money for this 30-day period, this cancellation period, you're not going to be able to give the money out 30 days, for those 30 days. Is there a, I don't know if it's called a restocking fee or something along those lines, that if this capital isn't going to be available to other consumers who may or may not qualify or have taken care of everything and know exactly what they want? And I'm just curious as to how you deal with that part of the bill.
Mr. Lemke, that's probably a banker's question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, I'm not exactly sure what it will do as far as the capital and what banks will decide to do with that money. I think the larger concern is probably more from the consumer standpoint of when they can actually obtain their money. If there's an opportunity for a 30-day rescission, I can't think of many of our members that would be willing to take that risk, and especially if it's a large sum of money to have it out if the rescission period is out there. 30 days. It also comes into play when it comes to locking in what rate you can get for someone. My understanding is they could bump up to federal guidelines, I think, allow for you to lock in for 60 days. Through this process, what may happen is it might run longer than the 60 days, and you might not be able to lock in at the rate that we'd like to lock you in at.
Follow-up?
Yeah, that was my fault. That was okay. My concern is that the rate. And the other question I had was about the cross-selling, because as someone who offered some bills on long-term care insurance to keep people in their house but also to keep them off the government rolls, and I wasn't laughing at your comments. I was worried about the glint in Representative or Chair Dabney's eye when you said we need some more licensing and we need more lenities. There's a glint in his eye, and it gives me a little chill.
All right.
But that was what I was concerned about, because, again, I understand the concept, but especially from a rural Minnesota standpoint, you know, how do you, maybe if they get one person in town handles mortgages, life insurance, car insurance, you know, property casualty, whatnot, are we going to make folks drive down from Ely down to Duluth or down to the city to get some of their products?
The as far as cross-selling, and it is a federal regulation with the HECM product right now, that it cannot be the same person selling reverse mortgages as selling the insurance products. And the risk of that is, and I had calls from lenders who have said, you know, you can make a commission if you also sell long-term care insurance. That's where the biggest conflict is. It's one and the same person. Some of us lenders cover the whole state, so, and I only specialize in reverse mortgages, and that's not a promotion for me. I'm not the only one that does that. But the point is that if somebody is selling insurance products, that's a different license. That should be a different sale versus the problem is those people are trying to talk people into doing the reverse mortgage so that they can get a commission on both, and that's where the problem is, and I am in total agreement that it should not be one and the same.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Chair, Representative Zellers, I'm sorry that Lutheran Social Service couldn't be here today because they would reinforce some of the very concerns Ms. Patterson raised in this area of cross-selling, that when they get that icky feeling when they're sitting down in one of the counseling sessions, it is often because there's some cross-selling going on that may or may not be being divulged by the elder in the counseling session. And that also goes to the issue of positively promoting, because we want to avoid a situation where unscrupulous individuals in the business, precisely, coach the senior into how they should answer, and that usually is then again that icky feeling for the counselor, and they know that there's more going on that they're not able to get to. So it goes to those two issues. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sanders, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Downey, kind of the other side of that coin, because I agree with exactly what you're saying there, and we want to protect that. The question, you know, I guess the further question is, you know, what is the intent of just flat out prohibiting it? Let's say it is a producer that has a different license, different company. Person who has a reverse mortgage actually goes to a producer and says, I would like to purchase long-term care insurance. According to this language, does that not prohibit that outright?
Mr. Dabney?
Chair, Representative Sanders, I think if you've got a reverse mortgage and you choose at a later point to purchase long-term care insurance with that, that's separate from the language in this bill. This bill is attempting to prohibit the location of that decision being the same room or the same business.
Okay, other questions? If not, then is there anybody else in the audience that would like to speak briefly, either for or against the bill? Okay, Representative Dabney, thank you very much for your testimonies. Representative Dabney?
Chair members, I think you're here. I think it's fair to characterize shared level of concerns from proponents and opponents. I think there's a great deal that we have in common, and I look forward to working with Mr. Lemke and others as we move forward to find a piece that we can all agree on to protect seniors going forward. I ask for your support.
Did you want to renew your motion then?
Why don't I renew my motion that House File 528 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
All right. Any other discussion? If not, then everyone hears the motion. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
And carried.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Zellers, I'm sorry. Thank you, sir.
Before we proceed with Representative Nelson's bill, learned staff has brought to my attention that these bills are technically still in the full Commerce Committee, and we're acting on Representative Nelson's and Hailstrom's bill today, and I'm just wondering if there was a procedural mistake if they didn't get moved down or printed this off this morning. So,
Representative Zellers, as you know, we memo these bills between the committees. My understanding is that a memo has been issued moving these bills to this committee. It may not have it may not appear on a website at this point in time, but the memo it has been passed between the right people.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for bringing up the concern.
Your beach.
Hmm?
Your beach, your rules.
All right. summer is coming soon. Reverend Nelson, would you like to move your bill, sir?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 1418 to be passed and recommend be passed and move to Commerce. So that's the place it has to go back up to. And
there we go. Reverend Nelson, please proceed with your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for hearing this bill today. This bill is basically a cleanup bill. It's a little bit more than a technical bill, but it comes out of the 2007 bill that established the plumbing board. And this board was modeled after the existing electrical board, which you can find in House or the statute 326.32. And like that board, the duties there are to oversee the plumbing codes and to make sure the plumbers keep up to date with changes in the industry. And part of this is through continuing education. When this was going through the process 2 years ago, there were multiple, I think it was 9 delete all amendments, I think I heard told me that when Representative Mahoney carried this bill through. And this was just kind of an oversight that they missed this little piece that exempted the board from doing or overseeing continuing education. And this is an important thing to keep our plumbers up to date as they go forward. And so that's the bill in its entirety. And I have Tom Joachim from the department here to testify for the bill and answer any questions.
Mr. Joachim, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'm Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. And I echo Representative Nelson's comments. Our code bill was almost a 100-page bill 2 years ago, and it went back and forth at a number of different events. And as everybody was trying to model the three boards that we have, plumbing, electrical, and high-pressure piping, multiple versions came forward, and this was missed in the final version of it. So this corrects that, which allows the plumbing board the responsibility to establish continuing education criteria for all people that we license as plumbers, master plumbers, journeymen, restricted master, water conditioning installers, etc. The board has makeup of all of those licensed individuals on the board, so that we think it's their responsibility to establish the continuing education to keep them up to date with new technology and new materials that come out every year. Thank you.
Do you have another testifier, Representative
Nelson? We have Kyle Crimmins here from the Plumbers.
Mr. Crimmins, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representatives. My name is Carl Crimmins, last name C-R-I-M-M-I-N-S. I'm the president of the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association, and we support this bill.
I like that. Wow. Anyone in the audience? Any questions for the author or testifiers, Representative Zeller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do remember Representative Mahoney's bill, and that was not pretty. So I, Representative Nelson, I don't know if introducing this on Friday the 13th is a good idea, but you're a braver man than I. The question I have is why we no longer want to advise the commissioner regarding the education requirements of plumbing inspectors. I would think that sharing information is always a good thing, but
Mr. Jordan?
Yeah, page two, line one, and 2.2.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I think you'll see the next bill, 1419, addressing the application of plumbing inspectors that we hire within the department, and so that really addresses that application. We currently in our process of hiring our plumbing inspectors. All of them are required to be licensed plumbers, master or journeyman plumbers, to do that. I don't know if that this section is really needed as to advise us what we're doing for our plumbing inspection.
Representative Zellers, there's probably a plumbing metaphor for how these two bills fit together, but I'm not going to try.
Through the knobbers.
Okay, there we go. Nelson will. Any other questions for the author or the testifier? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 1418? Seeing none, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 1418 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Any last words? Oh, that's a bad way to put it. Any final comments? Representative Nelson.
Well, in response to the Friday the 13th, it's always been lucky for me, so. And as a carpenter, we're always having to clean up after pipe fitters, and I just look forward to doing that. I was Representative Mahoney was here to hear me say that.
So does the chair. With that, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom has notified the committee that she is delayed at this time, and rather than hold over the bill, I'm a co-author on House File 1419 and offered to present it to the committee in her absence. I'd like to move that House File 1419 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
So moved.
Madam Chair and members, this bill, when it was brought to me, is to ask the co-author, it was presented very simply. Currently, state statute does not require that plumbing inspectors be plumbers. Trust me, you don't want me as a plumbing inspector. It is in the job description, but is not in state statute, and this is intended to close that. There's probably another plumbing metaphor about coming forward, but I'm not going there. With me today again is Assistant Commissioner Joachim and Mr. Crimmins.
Mr. Joachim.
Madam Chair, committee members, Tom Joachim, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Labor and Industry. As I stated earlier, our current practice when we advertise for plumbing inspectors is a requirement of a master license or a journeyman license, and this would also address that if we contract to perform services, which occasionally we do, that those people also be required to be a master plumber or journey plumber, and that's what our current procedure is. What we do, this just clarifies them all. We have multiple other job positions in our department that are also tied to licenses, and most of them in state law that address the same kind of criteria as this one does.
To your bill.
Mr. Crimmins,
do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, I just have the famous line that we are in favor of this bill.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Stand for any questions.
Have you any questions, members? Representative Sellers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so to testify, so this takes care of what the other the other bill, and if going forward any of the continuing education or the sharing of information part will be addressed, I'm assuming, in this bill.
Madam Chair,
Commissioner.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Question. Any other members in the audience who wish to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none. Representative Dabney, would you like to renew your motion?
Renew the motion that House File 1419 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay? The ayes have it.
Thank you very much.
Way.
Madam Chair, would you like to force one of the committee members to move approval of the March 11th minutes?
I would like to do that. Representative Nelson?
Thank you. So moved.
Thank you.
The minute first. You'll have it to set now.
Thank you. So moved. And we are now adjourned. Sorry, we have to vote on that. All right. All those in favor of the motion to move the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay? So moved. They are accepted.
And would you go ahead and adjourn the committee?
I would like to adjourn the committee. Thank you, sir. Thank you, members.
Thank you all.
Good travel. All right.